And you're listening to the Practice Power Up Podcast with your host, Damian Adler. Damian, the co-founder of Power Diary and a clinical psychologist, will bring to you proven strategies on how to run and grow your practice. Happy listening.
Welcome to today's webinar. Is your practice set up for balance or burnout in 2024? Wonderful topic for us to kick off on, and let's jump straight into it. So I will allow my co-presenter here, Mike, to introduce yourself and take it away.
Yeah, thanks for that, Damian, and thanks for having me. I'm really happy to be here. So my name's Mike Blackwell. I am the country manager for PhysiTrack for Australia and New Zealand. My background is I've been a physio for over 20 years. I was a physio practice owner in Sydney CBD from 2014 onwards, and then more recently have become working with PhysiTrack as their country manager. And burnout is a topic that, you know, unfortunately it's something that I have been through as a practitioner, and really keen to share sort of insights and what I learned from it, and hopefully how we can help some of you on here today to prevent it in future.
Very good. Thank you, Mike. And my name is Damian Adler. I'm one of the co-founders of Power Diary. I'm also a registered psychologist, and that's part of the story of how Power Diary came to be, in that we needed software to, you know, run our practice, and ended up developing that along with my brother. But I think from this topic, you know, is one very close to my heart, you know, as well. And, you know, in previous iterations of my career, so I've worked in public mental health as well. So working in hospitals and managing, you know, large teams where you see, you know, burnout, you know, certainly a, you know, something that's really quite significant and can take people out of the industry in the worst case, you know, scenario. And even less extreme than that, you can have still significant impacts in, you know. So I've seen that there. And then in terms of developing our own private practice, that was something that we just had to really kind of, you know, watch very carefully. And so I think when the opportunity came up for both for PhysiTrack and ourselves to do, you know, a webinar on this and talking to you in our initial sort of planning, that, you know, very clearly, you know, you've got this kind of passion for this topic. So, you know, really great that we could, you know, put this on jointly. And as you said, hopefully we can really help people get something really positive out of this, to find that balance between, you know, having an awesome 2024, but also doing it in a way that is sustainable and that, you know, doesn't come at the cost of health and well-being for anyone. So let's dive right in and talk about, you know, this idea of, you know, new year, new goals. And, you know, in 2024, we know at the start of every year, people tend to set their New Year's resolutions, and often, you know, are very ambitious with those, which is great. I fully, you know, it's great to sort of get in there and set some ambitious targets. But what can, you know, typically happen is either the New Year's resolutions or the New Year goals that people set, they either tend to fade, you know, over time, and people don't follow through, which we can, I'm sure, all relate to. Or alternatively, there's such focus on goals that might be set from a practice point of view that it can sort of come, you know, at the cost of the other elements of someone's life. And so we thought, you know, let's get into the start of the year and really talk about that and that balance. And the key thing here is really about remembering that you are often the, you know, the number one asset, you know, for the business, and that, you know, looking after yourself is not, you know, it's not a cost, it's not a reduction in efficiency, you know, by being measured in what we do, but it's actually looking after the number one, you know, asset of that business. And practitioners are the primary asset of any business. What's your experience, Mike, in this domain? I think you've got some personal experience in this scenario.
Yeah, for sure. So as I was saying before, I was the business owner of Fix Physio, which was a practice that I opened in late 2014. just me initially. You know, I was doing everything, marketing, the accounting, the this and the that, and the treating, obviously, and the cleaning and the tidy, you know, everything, as is often the way, keep those costs down. But gradually, you know, we got some traction. We added a practice manager in, we added more physios in, and you know, year on year, the business was growing, and we'd got it to about a team of seven, and things were going really, really well. And then we actually had a works social, which is one of the things we'll talk about here on, you know, trying to get that morale up and all that sort of stuff. So we hit a target for the company. We were on a boat in Sydney Harbour. And then the news started coming through on that Friday in March 2020 of, you know, everything's getting locked down. And it was, you know, naively, again, like a lot of people, I was very much kind of thinking, oh, we can ride this out. It'll be a week or two. It'll be fine. And like a lot of people, you know, how wrong was I? And, you know, we thankfully physio practice could stay open, but we went straight to telehealth. Anyway, long story short, over the course of the next few months, we had to let each one of those team go. Mm-hmm. Thankfully, with JobKeeper, we could keep some of them on. But essentially, it was just me then running the business. Mm-hmm. After another 6 to 9 months of hoping it would get better, we had to actually lose our location because it was just too big just for me. You know, despite government sort of guidelines on reductions in rent and that sort of side of things. So I combined forces with another physio practice, still in our separate entities in the Sydney CBD. And that went on for about another 9 months or so. She had to then give up her rent. So the two of us moved into another practice. So there was three really established CBD practices that had about 50 years of business between the three businesses that were working in one space just to pay the rent and pay the bills. Mm-hmm. And then after about two and a half years of doing that, I just throughout most of that I was burnt out, looking mm-hmm. back, but after 2.5 years of it, I was just like, I can't do this anymore. I can't keep waiting for this to get better. And that's when I made the move to PhysiTrack, which is something that I've been using for 7 or 8 years. But yeah, that was my burnout story, and yeah, had all the classic, you know, all the classic signs of it. But you know, it wasn't such a talked about topic back then. I just thought it was stress. I didn't realize it was a bit more than that.
Yeah, that's right. And I think you know, it's interesting that story about how we are before something happens, like when we. If, you know, when there's an unexpected event happens like COVID, obviously that was an extreme one, but the amount of reserves that we have, you know, going mm. like, you know, often dictates how we kind of are able to get through those things. And if people are running on a day-to-day basis and feeling kind of stressed and burnt out, they might be keeping it together, but mm. you know, it's utilizing maximum resources. Then when something comes along that disrupts that, then the amount of sort of leftover mm. Resources we have to deal with it obviously is minimal, and then the degree to which we can experience burnout, it comes on much faster. So you were saying before about it was a bit misunderstood, or that you had a different sort of view of it, or so when we think about burnout here, what are we talking about?
I mean, the official definition, as you can see there, is obviously that state of emotional, mm-hmm. physical and mental exhaustion caused by excessive and prolonged stress. I think for me, a couple of things. I couldn't concentrate. I would have a relatively simple low back pain patient that I could do with my eyes closed before COVID. And I was looking at this back and I couldn't put anything together. Like my mind was so active and so busy. So one of them was the lack of concentration. For me, again, everything was a huge effort. Like it wasn't like I would breeze through my normal day, you know, with 12, 14 patients, get it done, get my notes done. I could get to the end of the day at COVID, couldn't remember what I'd done with the first patient to write the notes, take 10, 15 minutes to write one set of notes, which would have normally taken me a minute or two. Yeah. So I'd probably say they were the, and I guess just that uncertainty around what was going to happen with COVID. But I mean, that's probably more COVID specific. But for me, yeah, concentration and how much of an effort everything was.
Yeah, And that started to be the first things that you notice, and then it can snowball, right? Because often when our performance goes down like that too, you get a build-up of other things that need to be done. And I've found often that also there's a feedback loop that can then become something that undermines people's confidence, their sense of competency, whether they start questioning about whether they're the right person to run a practice. If they're in a leadership role and supervising or owning a practice, then, you know, I've seen many times where people question their capacity, you know, to do that. And, you know, and that becomes, you know, obviously something that really, you know, just has a significant effect on every element.
You know, your productivity goes right down. You then maybe aren't doing as good a job. You then maybe aren't getting the referrals that you were before because you're not doing as good a job. And so on and so on, really. I think that just overwhelm is probably the best way to describe it, I would say.
Yeah, I think it's probably a good summary that a lot of people can kind of relate to. In terms of the causes, you know, I think there's not, and I think as you and I are talking, it's clear too, there's not a one-size-fits-all, there's not one cause, and there's not one subjective experience that people have. But the things that we know, like, that are kind of linked, you know, is things like working excessively long hours, and there being a lot of background stress in a workplace. The emotional and physical demands of patient care, and depending on the role, you know, they can be, you know, we know if we're looking at where there's a lot of physical activity required, then we know that actually has a build-up effect. But also the emotional side of things, which, you know, as a psychologist, and, you know, that's often something that's, you know, we can think of easily, but also for physios, right, you're often, you know, the patient doesn't come in with an isolated physical injury. They're a context as a person, right, that is part of that, and you have that kind of conversation, and, you know, you're exposed to a lot of that. Has an impact, right, particularly if you're already not in a great place yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you can't under emotional toll it takes on you as a allied health professional. I think, you know, looking at my cohort, I qualified in 2002 as a physio. Each year, less and less of my cohort are still being active practitioners, whether they're going into, you know, management roles. Obviously, I've gone into this role with PhysiTrack, part, you know, 20 hours a week. To treat 5 days a week full time is just, and, you know, I remember when I first qualified, you and I have chatted about this one in particular before, Damien, but when I first qualified, I was working at a clinic, and it was a private clinic, and I was treating 22 patients a day, 3 days a week when I was working there part-time. And I was only just qualified, so my thought processes and my clinical reasoning was much slower, not as advanced. But just talking to and taking 22 people's problems on every 30 minutes, I used to get home, and again, I'm pretty sure 99% of the audience will relate to this. I'd get home and I'd just sit there for half an hour, 45 minutes. And, you know, my partner at the time would try and talk to me, and I'm just like, I've got nothing. I cannot, you know, and that was in, you know, not in COVID time. So I think there's certainly some tricks and tips that can be learned. You know, I've heard everyone deals with it in their own way, but I think experience is the big thing. You know, you learn to be empathetic, but have a bit, still have a little bit of a barrier as you get more experience. So, but it's still a trap for sure. Like, it's easy to take that on board.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that idea of when you return home and you don't feel like talking, I often would describe that like, you know, I've run out of my word budget for the day. Yeah. You've got X number of words that you can say in a day. And yeah, that runs out. And you need almost like a recharge, a recoup time, you know.
Yeah.
But it's and while we're on that, you know, that understanding even of that, you know, can be, you know, make a really big difference in terms of practitioners' partners, right? Because if you get that half an hour downtime, if that's what you need, in my case, I was similar to you, right? That I'd need that, you know, time. But if a partner knows that, right, and just don't take it personally if I'm not that, you know, chatty, or I'm just a bit, you know, then, but in half an hour, I'll be right and I'll be there. Then it often avoids a whole lot of issues where people might get, you know, cranky, they respond, you know, not optimally, shall we say, and that leads to sort of a misunderstanding and all the rest of it. So just understanding those patterns. I think the other causes there, you know, too, is around, I think, the administrative workload. And there's good data on this that kind of shows that it's one of the top contributing factors to burnout in healthcare. And this is, you know, I think both where Physitrack and, you know, where Powerdiary, you know, this is the space that we operate in, right, is really, I think, for both companies are really passionate about reducing the administrative side of things and trying to make sure that things are running as efficiently, you know, as possible.
Yeah, definitely. I think there was a recent report by one of our sister companies, Champion Health, that took data, which is a workplace wellbeing software, and they took they had 1 million data points from about 4,600 employees. And the biggest cause of burnout and stress at work was workload. It was like 61% or something like that. Like it's workload, and, you know, obviously administrative tasks fit into that. People are just getting, the more able you are, the more work you often get piled onto you. And it's so I think workload and administrative tasks definitely something that we need to try and streamline as much as we can. Obviously there's certain things you can't avoid, but certainly for Fixed Physio, we made the decision not to see work cover patients because the rent that we were paying versus the pay that you were getting from work cover versus all the paperwork that was involved, we made a decision as a business that we wouldn't do that, which we didn't want to do, but it was just, we had to look after our practitioners. So that was the best way to do it, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's something that, you know, is in context of what we're talking about, setting up your practice in 2024, I had to think about the year there. But, you know, is around those things. So looking at what elements of the practice actually make sense, you know, from an operation, financial satisfaction, you know, point of view, and what elements maybe don't really make sense when you look at what things contribute to that kind of burden, and, you know, and doesn't make sense in terms of, you know, the other things that you consider when evaluating. I think that's a really good example there of cutting things. And certainly when we were running, my wife and I built a private, you know, psychology practice and grew that quite large, we had to make a number of those decisions along the way as well, that to say, okay, particular things just didn't make, you know, sense for us to do. And it can be a tough decision, but often by sort of cutting those things and saying we're just going to not go there, it allowed us to do other things sort of much better, you know. And so which then becomes a positive cycle. People enjoy it more, you know, you do it better, so you get a reputation for doing that in a good way, and it's no
more. So, and that whole thing about, you know, stress isn't that you've got a lot of necessarily work, it's stress if you don't enjoy it, it's that, whereas if you're doing a lot of stuff but you're loving it, then it's not stressful.
Exactly. And it's interesting when we talk about workload too, and we think about that idea of that what work you enjoy and don't enjoy, you know, when we're working, you know, obviously we've got practices using Powerdiary now, you know, all over the world, and so we get a lot of exposure. It's really good to hear, you know, and hear the stories of different people, what they like, what they don't. What's a really common theme, you know, is that even when people are busy, the actual patient work is typically not the thing that that sort of weighs on people. It's usually everything that goes around that, you know. It's the, you know, reports, it's the notes, it's the, you know, all the administrative kind of stuff. It's the fact that someone hasn't paid and you're chasing up something, and, you know, people not turning up to appointments and things like that, that tends to be the thing that actually kind of eats at people. And so when building like a sustainable sort of practice, and particularly if you employ people and you want to keep them engaged and keep them happy and you want to achieve the practice goals in 2024, then the idea, of trying to think about, okay, what is it that eats at practitioners? What leads to them feeling burnt out or feeling tired? It may be within reason, it may not be the clinical load necessarily, but it may be like all the stuff that goes around that. And so being trying to mindful of, well, how do we streamline the practice and reduce the sort of non-clinical work that practitioners need to do, then we tend to find that, you know, that it allows you to you know, grow, but also it is that kind of sustainability is then, you know, baked in.
Yeah, and that's it. And it kind of comes down to, you know, how do you retain your staff? You know, do you, as if you're a business owner, do you retain your staff? And what we always used to do was, right from the get-go, you know, say to our, without a guarantee that we could do it, but we would certainly consider it, what does your ideal work look like? You know, how many hours a week? How many patients do you want to see per day?
Yeah.
Do you like early start times? Do you like late finish times? Do you need a big gap in the middle of the day so you can pick up your children or do your exercise? Or what is your goal salary? And then we can work backwards and tell you how many patients you need to see to achieve that. You know, like, have those very open and frank discussions early on so that there's no gray areas. There's no, oh, well, you didn't do this and you didn't do that. Like, as I say, we couldn't guarantee that they would have, you know, 5 3-hour shifts a week with that, then they earn, you know, $200,000 a year, like, obviously. But we tried wherever we could. If, you know, one practitioner liked an early start, others didn't, you know, another one preferred to finish late, then we try and accommodate it that way and trying to keep them as happy as possible. Because they're far more likely to stay. And you know yourself, the amount of time and effort you put into a practitioner to train them up when you get them on board, like, you know, we were lucky, like, we didn't have any of the physios leave, actually, but it was, you know, with the admin staff, we had a couple leave, and you know, like, oh, spent 6 months training them up, go start again now. So you want to keep them on board.
Yeah, precisely. And the, you know, I think when you look at the stresses for practice owners, hiring and retaining practitioners, you know, comes right out there as sort of a number one, number two kind of growth, you know, either enabler or barrier. Yeah, exactly, because of that. So, you know, keeping, you know, and this is also where I think by being sensitive to work-life balance, to what actually ticks the right boxes for practitioners, you're able to create a work environment that you're not attracting and retaining people solely on trying to outbid how much you pay, you know, and getting into a bidding war, right, which does not go well for anyone at the end of the day. And so by being, you know, mindful of trying to set up an environment that, and in fact, it's interesting that you say that about what's your ideal, because we used to have a very similar kind of conversation with people at our psychology practice, and we also had extremely good retention, you know, of our team members over, you know, a long period of time. But was very much that to say, no one goes to, you know, university or to, you know, and thinks when they want to be a health practitioner, you know, and think about their dream is to sit around doing, you know, paperwork and chasing debts and doing all sort of stuff, right? They want to do the thing. So we sort of say, like, what is, you know, what is it that they want to do? And inevitably it's, you know, they want to do the client, you know, they want to do the client work. They want the least amount of other stuff to have to kind of deal with.
Yeah.
And they want it to be typically flexible so that it fits. There's a work-life balance there. It's done in a way that's kind of sustainable. And the same thing around working with pick up and drop off times for kids, whatever needs to be done.
Exactly.
It's good. All right, let's jump into these hidden sort of signs of burnout, because this is something that it can be sort of easy to miss, right? So what sort of things should we be looking out for?
Yeah, I mean, I think a couple of the points on there are really, really relevant, you know, so that when, if you're a business owner or you see a colleague, when a patient cancels and they go, oh, thank God, like, I just needed 5 minutes. And you're just like, hang on a minute. Like, it shouldn't be that way. It should be that they, you know, they enjoy their job. They're not overworked. They should be disappointed because, you know, if they're on commission, for example, they're going to lose that commission because that patient hasn't turned up. So that would be one. I think if you overhear a colleague, you know, sometimes clinics have the curtains as opposed to separate rooms, or if you hear them in the gym and they just don't seem or sound or body language that interested or sympathetic or empathetic is probably the better word, then I think that can certainly be one. Like I was saying before, when I was looking at the person's back, who I've treated a million backs and lumbar spines, and I was forgetting what to do. I was forgetting how to assess and treat a back during that period of burnout. So yeah, similar sort of thing, or, you know, making administrative errors or forgetting to call someone back, or, and then just somebody that, if somebody's usually sort of visually bubbly within the clinic, this isn't always easy. There was a great post on social media I saw recently where there was two football fans in the crowd, and one of them was really jovial and one of them was really sad. And it was basically about, you know, you knew what was coming. There was going to be some messaging around suicide prevention, but you thought it was going to be the person that was miserable, but it was actually the really jolly person that wasn't there on the final scene. His seat was empty. So I just think, yes, you can sometimes pick that up, but sometimes, you know, people often who die by suicide are masters of disguising and hiding those things, and you don't know till it's too late. So that is one to think about, but it's not always that obvious.
It's a change too, isn't it? That I think when I'm looking at burnout, it's the change in the normal presentation of that clinician, for instance, or it could be ourselves. But if they normally have a kind of fairly light demeanor, like you say, it doesn't necessarily mean there's not other stuff going on. But
yeah,
if you see that and then there's a change, or the, is to find the general attitude, like, or the environment that they kind of perpetuate and create around them. So, you know, if you can tell sometimes when someone's like a dark cloud hanging over them, or they're, you know, they're kind of, the way they're interacting with things, it's sort of very, like, you know, it's heavy, and that's a change. Often, they're often not even aware themselves. They might just sort of think, I'm just a bit stressed or a bit tired and sleep well, you know, something.
Yeah.
But when it's like, you know, consistent, then that's where I think having that kind of conversation, you know, and just checking in with them, you know, often is the kind of, you're scratching the surface and you find there's all this other stuff that is there.
Yeah, and if they look distant or withdrawn, I guess a lot of these colleagues can pick up on these previous ones. The last one, you know, you might not be able to pick up that one of your colleagues has, you know, lost their appetite or, you know, poor sleep, unless they report to you, I'm not, you know, lost my appetite, and I've, you know, so that might be a more difficult one. But equally, it's not just about other people realizing, it's about yourself. I didn't realize at the time I was going through burnout. So now being armed with these things where I'm like, oh yeah, I wasn't sleeping at all when I had burnout, you know, my mind was so busy and worried about, you know, how am I going to pay the next bill and what's going to happen to this business that I've nurtured and grown and has been our future, our family's future for the last 7 years. You know, I wasn't hungry, you know, all those sort of things. So it's often good to know these things, because you might not actually realize yourself that you're going through it. And then you can, you know, hopefully you will action something. You will speak to them. We'll talk about, you know, what to do and all that sort of stuff later on in the talk. But yeah, it's, they're the common ones. Are there any others that you can think of?
Like, no, I didn't think so. I just sort of would look at the ripple effect too of this, you know, that, yeah, it makes sense when we think about all those kind of symptoms that, you know, you get this sort of, you know, team morale, workplace atmosphere, everything kind of takes a bit of a downer, and it can really then impact on the goal, you know, when people will set goals for their practice and are trying to achieve things. And then if burnout isn't being attended to, you can see that these kind of ripple effects that aren't necessarily as immediately evident, they start to work against the goals that people kind of set for their practice. So they think, oh, you know, my goal this year was to, you know, increase by 30% or to hire, you know, some more people, but I just hired some more, but the other ones left.
Yeah.
You know, and that kind of feeling that, you know, this ripple effect is often more broad than what we kind of think about, or we don't sort of think of it as a whole. We kind of might focus on one area of it, but not realize actually this is, you know, it's all connected. So things like, you know, that personal health, how people are at home, you know, and of course the finances of the practice, and you know, how optimistic people are feeling about the operation of their practice and what the future holds, all sort of has this, you know, this ripple effect, and can become a chain reaction, right? Like it's like if you're interviewing for a practitioner, if you have like the whiff of desperation,
yeah,
you know, because behind the scenes you're feeling, you know, all sorts of things are going on.
Yeah,
it's like it, just like dating or something, right? Desperation never attractive, you know. So
no, exactly. I think there was one thing that I think it'd be good to go over as well, which I think yourself and I talked about this previously as well, I mean, is the financial aspect, both from the business owner and from the, you know, the practitioner, particularly with the cost of living crisis that's going on sort of globally at the moment, you know, the goals need to be aligned. It's no good a business owner going, I need physio A to see 50 patients a week, and physio A is going, I can't see 50 patients a week. I'll be absolutely flogged. I'll be burnt out. I won't be doing a good job, but I actually probably need to see 45 to pay my rent, to pay my bills. But even that's too many. I really want to be seeing more like 35, 40. So kind of thinking about all those sort of things. And then we talk about, you know, how do we help with burnout? Well, again, we'll talk about more detail later on, but, you know, putting gaps in your diary, you know, all those sort of things. But then equally, that does mean then that you're not going to earn as much. So it's this constant sort of weighing up of, I need more money, but if I see that many patients, I'm going to be burnt out. So yeah, it's a real, and then there's no like magic solution to that. It's just something that you have to work out. And, you know, that can be things like increase the fees in the the clinic, yeah, fees, which I think as practitioners we're all very, very reluctant to do, mm-hmm, despite our costs going up year on year significantly. It's something that I was always pretty strict on, that, you know, just $5 a year will increase our standard consults. Doesn't sound a lot, but when you add that over a whole practice for a week, it adds up. And, you know, you worry about increasing your prices, you worry about the backlash, and in my whole 8 years of having a business, nobody ever questioned it. Like, yeah, it's ever. So I think my biggest advice to every practice is revisit them, do a little bit of research in your area, like what is everybody else charging? And that shouldn't dictate your answer, but it should just, you know, if you think you're a 50% better physio than everyone else in the area, then, you know, your prices should be matched accordingly. But that's certainly one way to ease some of the financial burdens. As I say, it doesn't sound like a lot, but it is, like cumulatively.
Work smarter, not harder. Power Diary, the complete practice management system for allied health professionals. Our all-in-one system with over 100 powerful features for health practitioners includes appointment scheduling, client messaging, soap notes, telehealth portal, payment integrations, and much, much more. Let Power Diary streamline and simplify your day-to-day operations so you can take care of clients. Join a live demo or start a free trial today. Learn more at www.powerdiary.com.
Yeah, and I think this is where, you know, if we're looking at goal setting and how, you know, we achieve what we want, you know, it's very easy to skip over that and think, okay, I'm going to focus on just growth, right? I'm going to employ more people. I'm going to get a bigger building, a bigger whatever it might be. But what we, you know, I've seen over the years, you know, both running a practice and being, you know, friends and colleagues and all that running, but particularly in the Power Diary, where we just get a global view of what, you know, the things people do that work really well and the traps people get into. Is that if they don't have those things sort of sorted out, they just scale the problem, you know. So they have a problem as a three, you know, person practice. When they get to a 5 or a 7 or a 15 person practice, if they haven't attended to those things, like you're saying, if the economics of it don't make sense at the small level, it tends not to make a lot of sense at the larger level. And it's the same with administrative tasks, the same with every sort of aspect. So sort of when you're looking at like goal setting, what are we going to achieve in 2024, it's important to look at those sort of fundamentals and just like and work out, you know, hey, are we charging enough to, you know, make enough profit to pay team members enough so that we can, you know, keep them engaged, but also, you know, not end up with burnout due to financial issues. And when decisions about increasing price are based like around that sort of foundational thinking, it's a lot easier, I think, to get over that barrier of doing it, because you're like, well, actually, for sustainability, to be able to continue to deliver services in a way that, you know, is sustainable, this is a reality. You know, this is what we need to do, and you know, then we do it with confidence because that's how it is, rather than it being an afterthought or a catch up. You know, where you have to sort of increase by,
yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
And then you're doing it from a place of kind of, weakness or feeling stressed rather than, a proactive, like you say, every at least 12 months, review of fees, and increasing, increasing those. And my experience has been the same. I'd like to say that I've, super confident increasing fees in the psychology practice. I wasn't at all. I would always get a bit concerned, a bit anxious, but it was silly. And as the years went on, we got much better at it, at sort of adjusting. But every time, like you put the fees up, no one, a few grumbles here and there maybe, but no, it did. It made no negative impact on the business at all. It was always upside.
Yeah, for sure.
So I think that's right. In terms of the kind of practice well-being sort of side of things, what I think we've sort of touched on a lot of this here, but if we sort of now think about strategies that we can do, and we're going to kind of move now into talking about things that really can help. What do we need to do from a personal and sort of practice well-being perspective here to get it right?
I think communication's obviously got to be at the forefront, and I think that your employees have that psychological sort of safety that they can speak up, they can say I don't agree with this, or this happened, or knowing, and whether that be in a group situation, whether that be one-on-one, so giving them plenty of opportunities to have conversation, that communication, making yourself as the business owner available, not always be running out the door. I always schedule half an hour one-on-one with each of the team members, both practitioners and admin staff, every week. So we had half an hour where we could talk. Maybe there'd be some businessy things, but a lot of it would be, how are you doing? Is there anything that we can do better? Is there anything that you think we could change? We'd have that also in a fortnightly team meeting, a 1 hour team meeting. So, if there's something they brought up and they felt comfortable talking about it in the group setting, we'd discuss it, we'd nut it out. And if it was a good idea and it made good business sense and it was good for the culture of the business, we would do it. So I think having that psychological sort of safety would be one, and basically lead by example. So for example, if me as the business owner was seeing 22 patients a day back to back without a break, in from 7 a.m there till 7 p.m well, everyone else is going to think, oh well, I better do that, the boss is doing that, that's what he expects. So the boss, the practice owner, if they're still treating, scheduling in those breaks, going out for my lunch, not doing my notes as I'm having a sandwich on my desk, scheduling in into my diary potentially, some exercise time, some meditation time. As a business, having regular out of work catch-ups, whether it be, we had one about once every quarter, and had a policy of, right, if there's any work stuff, we talk about it in this first 5 minutes. after that, work is a dirty word. So I think that was really important. And you see a lot of different sides of people. Like, we did one of the best ones for showing real personality traits of your team, and you're learning about your team, and not in a negative way, like in a good way. We did a panic room as one of our, and it was just, we were all in the same room, but in teams, and just watching how a certain team member just was 100 miles an hour straight in without really thinking about it. And then you've got the other person who has sat back for a bit, took their time, but ultimately got there quicker with the, sort of worked it out. So I think stuff like that, really. And I think, the regular breaks in your diary, having a mentor within the business to talk about clinical patients, because I used to say to them, don't ever think that you not knowing an answer to a question or knowing how to get your patient better is a problem. If you're not coming to me with two or three patients a week that you're not sure what to do, if you're a junior physio, I'm more worried, because I know that at that stage of your career, there will be at least two or three patients that you don't know what to do next. And treatment's not going well. So I just kind of, I encouraged not maybe not encouraged is the wrong word, but I emphasize how failure is going to be part of your day-to-day, and that's okay. As long as you're not making the same mistakes over and over again, you know, it's that usual thing.
Yeah, and I think on that, I think you sort of see this a lot, but the more that you can sort of model that as well as the leader, so in that sort of part of creating that environment that you're talking about where it's sort of safe to talk about things that, you know, I would say that our practice, and I see a lot of practices do this, that, you know, they'll have either informal case conferences or education sessions, information sharing and so forth, obviously being mindful of confidentiality and so forth. But but that's where, when I was operating clinically more, you know, I would be just as overt about what I didn't know as anyone else, right? And if I was stuck with a patient, I would ask, you know, different people for their opinion, advice, discussion, and to sort of create that it's not a hierarchical thing. And it was done genuinely too, not as a just an exercise, because often, you know, people have different experiences. The person who's just graduated and is, you know, the newest person in your team, they often have a different perspective, or they've had, you know, some recent exposure to training that I wouldn't have received. And, you know, it really can come from anywhere. But I think when people see that, you know, see that being modeled, they're more likely to kind of think, oh, well, that's, you know, that's okay. He doesn't know everything, or he struggles at times, or gets stuck, or feels overwhelmed, or whatever it might be, then it's okay for me too. And you kind of get that, you get that kind of, you know, flow on sort of effect of people feeling comfortable.
Yeah. And I think as well, like boundaries, like both with your colleagues and particularly as the business and with your patients, like don't give your mobile number out to your patients. They can communicate with you via your work email. They can communicate with you at the clinic during your work hours. It's not acceptable for a patient to be, you know, calling you, texting you out of work hours. So those boundaries, but equally as an employer, you know, when the practitioner's left, you know, they've done their work hours, don't be calling them at 8 or 9 o'clock at night saying, oh, I just wanted to ask you about this, or can you do this for me? And, you know, so boundaries both with, you know, your team, or if you are an employee, making sure that your manager's aware of those boundaries as well. But certainly with patients, because there's so many ways that patients can communicate with you now. You know, they could, through PhysiTrack, you can communicate instant messaging. And a lot of companies choose to switch that off, which is possible, because for me it was my work email, it was through reception, it was through feedback. So yeah, just knowing and educating your patients on when is okay to sort of, and it doesn't have to be a harsh conversation, like it's you know, it's just the reality.
Yeah, exactly. And setting that up at the start means that, you know, people don't get upset later if they contact and they don't get a sort of immediate, you know, reply. And I think the other, you know, things about getting this, you know, right is making sure that we're kind of, you know, we're doing those things of taking time off, and we're, you know, but also we're balancing our professional life with the non-professional. So that elements of, you know, hobbies, activities, whatever you sort of enjoy doing outside of work, you know, it makes a big difference. And even in recruitment, you know, I like to get a sense, as much as we're legally allowed to ask, you know, but get a sense of what people do, like, to balance out their life, to see whether they're someone who is, you know, is in the habit of having a good balance, that they're not all just, you know, entirely professionally focused and you know, it's likely to sort of have issues. So looking at that and then fostering discussion of that in the workplace as well, which, you know, often seems, you know, counter to what, you know, people sometimes do, but like actually, you know, making space for that kind of is good and encouraging that. And then I think that idea of seeking support, and that can make a huge difference. You know, you sort of look at, you know, you've got colleagues that maybe own practices or are doing something similar. It doesn't have to be a formal supervision or a formal, but just having that kind of regular touch point with people that you know, relate to, and that, you know, can make such a big difference, because they see things, you know, they have a different perspective.
Yeah, sure. And I think just that whole thing about sharing a worry or a trouble, instantly you kind of feel your shoulders just go, you know, like it's because we can all ruminate over things, like we can kind of all go over and over and over it in our head, and then it becomes bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. When we actually say it out loud and somebody goes, well, that's no big deal, what are you worried about?
Exactly.
Not always, but often, you know, often. perspective, isn't it, really?
Yeah, exactly. So let's jump into strategic goal setting and why, you know, this is important and how to do it. So I'll let you kick off with this. I know you and I have discussed this a fair bit. What are we talking about here when we're looking at strategic goal setting?
So I think obviously SMART goals, I've wrote this down before the talk because I always get it wrong. It's specific, measurable, achievable, relevant, and time-bound. Mm-hmm. So, you know, setting your goals, but not just setting your goals for work. Also, in a second column, setting your goals up for your personal life. And then looking, do those two actually work together? Or have you said, I want to work 60 hours a week and then I want to, I don't know, go sailing 20 hours a week? Well, it doesn't leave much time for, you know, sleep and everything else in life. So just, I know it's an obvious one, but making sure your work goals really do match up with your personal goals. And I for Fixed Physio, the business we had, I set up with the team, we did it collaboratively, our core values for the business and our mission statement or purpose. And our decisions all went through those core values. If there was ever a decision for the business where it was like, oh, should we do that? Shouldn't we do that? Well, hang on a minute. Does it match up with our business core values? If it didn't, then we'd go, well, we're not doing that. And equally, same with your personal life. Like if it doesn't, you know, if you've got three or four or four or five personal core values and it doesn't match up with that, then you don't do it. And there was that, I think we were chatting earlier as well about that whole, and you know, you can't always do this because sometimes you have to do things you don't want to do in work because if you're not the boss. But if it's not a hell yeah, then, you know, don't necessarily do it. If you've got the choice, you know, it's got to excite you, as have your goals. And yeah, as the smart things, it's got to be realistic as well. And time bound, you know, you can't just go, I want to learn how to play the guitar. Okay, well, you know, what song do you want to learn? How long does it want to take you? How much time are you going to allot it per week? Where are you going to do it? Is the guitar in the cupboard? So that's a barrier, or is it already out? I'm speaking from experience here because I've been trying to teach myself to play the guitar since I was about 20 and I'm pretty awful still. So yeah.
and we're going to send out a worksheet. So to everyone watching, we've actually developed a worksheet on this about developing goals and having these personal and professional goals and the two columns, and then the step-by-step, you know, how to implement as well, which, you know, using the kind of SMART principles. So we'll attach that in an email that we'll send out to everyone with this. And the key thing around this is that, like, when you're achieving in both departments, professional and personal, the energy in both, like, one fuels the other. You feel good at work, then you're more likely to feel sort of motivated, fired up at home. You're feeling fired up at home and you're feeling good about that, your whole life isn't just work, then that energy translates back. So this, you know, when we're talking about these balance, this is really about being able to achieve what you want to achieve, but do it in a way that isn't at the cost of something else and that's actually kind of, you know, is sustainable. And that leads us to this sort of, you know, burnout plan, which we have we'll send out as part of this this handout tool that you can use, which is really just helping you kind of formalize what it is that you want to achieve for this year personally and professionally, and then how you can do it in a way that, you know, attends the things that we're talking about and doesn't lead to burnout. Okay, yeah. So let's jump into just mindful of the time, and we just got a couple more things to cover off on. Okay, embracing technology and, you know, tools to achieve the goals with less stress. So let's hit this one. This is the space, right, for both BusyTrack and us. So take it away when we're looking at what should we do here with technology.
Yeah, I mean, look, it won't be a huge sales pitch for BusyTrack. It's this is more about kind of how we can help each other, you know, learn from our own sort of experiences. And for me, the biggest resistance to, or sorry, the biggest help that using digital will give you and using, you know, softwares and apps is it will free up your time. Mm-hmm. If it frees up your time, you then have either more time to treat more patients if that's what you want, or more time to work on your personal goals and you work on the tasks that you want to do. So we always find that there's a huge, with anything, there's always a resistance to change. Oh, I haven't got time for a new software. I haven't got time to implement this. And that's why you need a real plan. You can't just go, we're going to start using FizzyTrack or we're going to start using Power Diary. You know, it has to go through phases. Probably the business owner has the idea, I want to use this new software. The knee-jerk reaction of the team is, oh, we haven't got time for this. So then it's like, well, why do I want to use it? What is it about this software that is going to make all of our lives easier? We're going to be more productive. We're going to then be healthier and happier and have, you know, better patient outcomes. So that your why is always really important. And then having a time frame of when it's going to be done, how it's going to be done, blocking that time off in the diary, and actually diarizing it that on Tuesday at 2 till 3, we're going to go through with the team what FizzyTrack's all about. We've organized a demo with Mike. He's going to come in and do that. Or, you know, we've still got a paper diary in the clinic. We're still taking cash payments. You know, we're going to start to use Power Diary. Invoicing is going to be much easier. Diary and online booking. So, you know, there was a stat about how something crazy, like 70 or 80% of all medical appointments, people want to book them outside of working hours, as in not to attend the appointment, but they physically want to book it. Yeah. So if you haven't got online booking, like, you're losing so much business. So it's a no-brainer. Like, you just have to adopt and use these things. As a business, we use, not name dropping particular softwares, but for us, we had an accountancy software that we used. We had obviously FizzyTrack. We had an EMR diary software. We had, you know, so it just made, and also from a space perspective, previous clinic I worked at had a room, because it had been around for about 25 years, had a room full of patient notes in filing cabinets. And we had 59 square meters where we had 2 treatment rooms, a reception area and a gym. So we didn't have room for that. So forgetting the efficiency piece, think about the space piece with that. And then with the exercise prescription softwares, the compliance, like, that's the biggest thing that I talk about when I do my demos for FizzyTrack, is the increase in compliance with exercise is incredible when you go from your stick diagrams or even your photos on a sheet of paper to a digital, doesn't have to be FizzyTrack, obviously I'd love it if it was, but any digital exercise prescription software, you will improve your compliance of your patient's exercise. That's my little
I think at the heart of that is that, like, by utilizing technology, the technology, what it does when utilized well, is it does the things for you that clinicians and, you know, people don't like doing, right? So, you know, and that's where, like, you know, I think you should never do, like, manually something that, you know, can be automated or that technology can kind of do for you. Yeah. And ideally, you're not paying someone to do something that technology can also, you know, do for you from an efficiency point of view. So from FizzyTrack, we'd like you to use our platform. We both think that obviously we think, you know, we do the best we possibly can to really hit these goals and make this life easier for practitioners. But more generally, that idea of, you know, you're not embracing technology for technology's sake or because you feel like you should, but actually the things that kind of cause burnout, we know, are the things that typically are stuff that people don't enjoy or that gets on top of them. And it's typically not the clinical load is not necessarily the primary driver of it. So by doing that, you're able to kind of, really help achieve the goals that you want without, amplifying your, your overheads and amplifying the kind of administrative burden that goes with it. So
yeah,
it's good.
Yeah, and I think as well, like, if there's any business owners on the call, like, it will enable you to scale so much easier. If you start having multiple clinics, you know, you can still have the same FizzyTrack account, the same Power Diary account. It's just going to make it so much easier for you to scale if that's what you want to do. And then there was just one more point I wanted to make. Yeah, so sort of that, you know, patients actually get better care. So the fact that if they're more compliant with the exercise, they're more likely, as long as the physios prescribe the right exercise or the right group of exercises, they're more likely to get better. The more likely to get better, they're going to be much happier about their treatment. Mm-hmm. They're going to refer two or three of their friends and family to you. Again, it will help you scale and grow. If they keep coming to physio appointments and they're not having done their exercise because it was on a sheet of paper, they're not going to go, oh, I didn't get any better, but Mike's a great physio, go and see him. Like, they're only going to say that if they don't owe me anything. Like, it's they're only going to say that if they actually had a good result.
Yeah.
So, absolutely. Yeah.
At the end of the day, like, that's, it's, we think about things in health that sort of can be draining and things that add energy, and positive patient feedback, patients getting better, and you're seeing that. At the end of the day, it's what we're all here for, right, as practitioners. And that's something that adds energy into the mix, you know, and provides that, you know, it's the fuel, right? Yeah. And so when, like you say, anything that you do that kind of supports patient, you know, outcomes, obviously it's great for patients, and, you know, that's what, but also that the, for the practitioner, it's a much better, you know, much better experience, and it's what they're there for.
Yeah, for sure.
Right, so wrapping up, so where to from here? So we're going to send out a link to the tool that we're talking about in terms of basically around setting your goals and an anti-burnout plan. And then also we're also going to send a link to a burnout guide that PhysiTrack, you've developed, right, with PhysiTrack.
Yeah, so it's just the, I've just got it here. It's in black and white, unfortunately, but you will get it in nice and color if you download it. So that's just the Cooling Off, How Practitioners Can Beat Burnout guide. It was created, there was three physios of varying experience. Myself was one of them. Another physio called Tom Gray, who's works for PhysiTrack, and he's also a lecturer in physio. And then Leah Gillespie, who's basically my equivalent in the US. So between us and our marketing team, put this document together. We hope it's, you know, you get some insights from it. A lot of it we've already discussed today, but maybe as follow-up for yourself, and that you can actually put some solid things in place to actually move on for us. You know, what we don't want from today is you go, oh, that was interesting, and forget all about it. We want you, the action plan from today is that you go out, and even if it's, you know, on the guide, there's, I don't know, probably 20 actionable points that you can do that we found can help prevent burnout. Even if you take three of them, the most relevant to you, like, we don't want the guide to be overwhelmed going, oh my God, I've got to do 20 steps to prevent burnout, but it's actually causing me burnout. So, you know, you take what you will from today and what you will from the guide, but it's a free resource there. Share it with your team, and hopefully, you know, you'll get some benefit from it.
Wonderful. Thank you, Mike. And that takes us to that final point of remembering to sort of take action and start small. So thank you very much, Mike. It's been great fun developing this and presenting, you know, together. And thank you to everyone for coming along and participating. Hope you got something great out of it. And there's some contact details. We'll send this slide package out, but some contact details there as well if you'd like to follow up with PhysiTrack or Mike or Powdery. So once again, thank you, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks, everyone.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Practice Power Up Podcast with Damian Adler. Come back often and make sure you subscribe, rate, and review our podcast. Your feedback is important.